Welcome to today's episode of The Global Novel, where we delve deep into the intricacies of Gustave Flaubert's seminal work, Madame Bovary. Today, we're incredibly fortunate to have an esteemed panel of experts to unpack the layers of this literary masterpiece. Joining us are Professors Mary Donaldson-Evans, who taught at University of Delaware, Jennifer Yi from Oxford University, Rachel Mash from Boston University, and CFS Creasy from National Yangming Xiaotong University in Taiwan. And I'm your host, Claire Hennessy. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you so much for inviting me to participate. It's a great pleasure.
So glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you.
Let us begin our journey into the heart of Flaubert's Normandy to understand the timeless allure of Madame Bovary and why it continues to resonate with readers and scholars alike. Mary, in your own words, what is the novel about?
At the most basic level, Madame Bovary is a story of an adulterous woman. Emma is deeply disappointed in married life. She had read romance novels in her spare time, and her dreams were filled with passionate love affairs and knights in shining armor. In short, there's a huge gap between Emma's dreams and the reality of her married life. In time, she seeks passion in love affairs, but they bring her only fleeting happiness. What strikes me above all, since it's not the simplicity of its plot, Flaubert's narrative style, the impersonal narration, which was quite new for the time, and what's been called the indirect free style, translated in various ways, style indirect libre, but that it was absolutely new at the time. It was the narrator does not tell the reader what to think. The reader is very active in this novel because there's no judgment. You know, the language, the irony, the reader draws his or her own conclusions.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything that Mary just said, and that even though Flaubert is sort of absent in terms of guiding us what to conclude about these characters, the way that he takes us and introduces us to them is so precise and so clear and so deliciously ironic that you can, when you teach it, you kind of have to, I end up sort of stopping on every sentence. I'm trying to get somewhere and then I have to just, you're sort of just reading out loud to let these sentences hang there. Because even though they don't tell you exactly what to think, they portray these characters in such a specific way and in such a modern way, they set them up in such a way. Flaubert is taking us through and is portraying them with just such precision that sets us up to see and sets up these character situations in such a sort of tense and suggestive way. Because the other piece of it that really strikes me at the novel is that it's a kind of anti-hero novel. If that's Emma is an anti-hero. We love an anti-hero. Modern storytelling is rife with anti-heroes because they give in to their desires, right? That's right. What we love in modern storytelling. And so this sort of announces that new venture and without judgment, right? That's a big part of it. And so that we love a character who we're allowed to just watch descend into their feelings, give in to those desires and make bad choices.
Flaubert's one of his signal innovations is this kind of narratorial neutrality, which often proceeds by way of what's called style indirect libre, free indirect style, or free indirect discourse, you know, inhabiting a position that's kind of mixed between an external narrator and the character, sort of allowing us access to the way that character thinks or the texture and grain of that character's thoughts while maintaining the voice of a narrator. And he didn't make this up, although he was, you know, one of the chief innovators of it. Jane Austen is another classic example. When Jane Austen does it, it's almost always a matter of irony, right? Darcy thinks this, but he's an idiot because he's wrong, right? Or whatever. There's a way in which showing what the character thinks is measured implicitly against the objective reality. Now, Flaubert does that sometimes also with Bournisien, the abbot, or Homais, or Charles, And he does it occasionally with Emma, but it can also be a way of not establishing distance and irony and judgment, but of establishing that there's no firm boundary. That is to say, it's a way of engaging in empathy or sharing.
Thank you, Sanders. Free indirect style is indeed one of the most important and intricate narrative strategies of Flaubert's, as you just pointed out. Apart from this, the novel also explores the pitfalls of imagination, daydreams, and the concept of Bovarism. So Jennifer, could you elaborate on what Bovarism is and how Flaubert uses these elements to craft Emma's character and the narrative's trajectory? How do these aspects contribute to what goes wrong in her life and then the novel's broader critique of society?
Yes, well, I think Mary has already mentioned Emma's romantic reading and the fact that she's disappointed with life. And so the idea of Bovarism is linked to this. In fact, the word Bovarism is coined later, a couple of decades after Flaubert's death in the 1890s, by a French philosopher called Jules de Gautier. And what he means by Bovarism is basically the human ability to imagine that one is something that one isn't really. And so he sees it as a universal quality of most humans, or the better humans, one might say. And so in the case of Emma, obviously Flaubert didn't coin the term, but what we see in the case of Emma is that she's been reading things and looking at images, and she has ideals that are incompatible with her married life. And some of this is to do with, the critique of society. Some of it is to do with class. Some of it's to do with geography. Emma is trapped in a small village. She's part of the provincial petit bourgeoisie, but she dreams of living like a member of the aristocracy, and she dreams of living in Paris. But some of it's not about class. So among the novels that she's read, the one that Flaubert talks about most is called Paul et Virginie. Mm-hmm. And it's the story of two chaste young lovers who live on the island of Mauritius. And they're both French, but they are able to live a life of harmony and peace, because their lives are protected by enslaved people who live on the island. There's a kind of trope of kind masters, devoted slaves, which creates a kind of pastoral idyll. So that the heroes don't have to work, they don't have to demean themselves in that way. And it's also an idyll in which sex is kind of not really there. You know, they're in love with each other, but it's very pure. It's just pure emotion. So the frustrations of Emma's life are to do with having to live in a world in which there's money and work and people have sex, and the sex isn't, you know, this perfect dream of a perfect right. relationship. Mm-hmm. So her ideals are incompatible with the real world. If the idea of Bovarism is what Flaubert is really getting at, then is he using Emma's case to explore a universal human dilemma? Mm-hmm. Or on the contrary, does he think that is he showing us problems that are specific to her condition as a woman of the 19th century? And those are two different interpretations of the novel, and Flaubert doesn't tell us what to think. And this is largely because he has this doctrine of authorial impersonality. So he's trying to take the narrator out of the text and leave the reader to really fill in the interpretation. So in favor of thinking that it's a universal quality, you might remember that. So Flaubert was a great admirer of Don Quixote. Mm-hmm. And Don Quixote is a male character who suffers from Bovarism. You could call Emma a female Don Quixote.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, you could say that Flaubert is very specific about Emma's situation as a woman. Mm-hmm. She herself is really frustrated at being trapped. And when she's pregnant, she hopes that it will be a boy. She's going to call him Georges. And she says that he will be able to do the things that she couldn't do in her life. And then when she has her affair with Leon, it's starting to go a bit stale.
Right.
She goes quite wild. She wears velvet trousers, which is radical in the 19th century. She smokes cigarettes. So she's the dominant personality in their relationship. And I think Rachel might disagree with this, but I don't think that Flaubert is asking us to judge Emma's sexuality. I think, and that is the reason why he was taken to court. There's no condemnation of her adultery. I think he's asking us to look at her mind and see what's gone wrong and what has maybe gone wrong for many of us.
Exactly. And I think it is precisely this subtle representation of character's psyche that continues to be what drives many other versions of the novel, frankly, television and film that are also very successful in the 20th century. So Mary, what makes Madame Bovary suitable for adaptation to the screen? What do you think are the aspects that make the novel, let's say, film worthy?
Actually, the first Hollywood version was in 1932, and it was entitled Unholy Love. The versions that are that stay closest to the novel are entitled Madame Bovary, but there are many other films which are inspired by the novel. It's, first of all, Flaubert's descriptions are highly visual, and that's perfect for the filmmaker. That's it's irresistible. There are so many grand scenes: the agricultural fair, the club foot operation, the wedding, the country wedding, the ball. There are so many scenes like that that are just made for the screen. And so that would be the first thing I would say that has tempted filmmakers. The subject, frustrated desire, it's eternal. And that, too, makes this novel that's very, very adaptable. Also, the camera has been compared to the impersonal narrator. It doesn't judge, it shows. The showing versus telling. All of those things have tempted filmmakers, and some... Flaubert's style was even considered proto-cinematic. There's the agricultural fair. There's a cross-cutting between the discourse of the town functionaries and Rodolphe's seduction of Emma, and it's highly ironic and very successful. And that also seems almost made for the movies. So obviously, in 1857. Film did not yet exist. So, and Flaubert himself said he refused offers to have his novel illustrated. He refused even a simple photograph. So it's interesting to speculate whether he would have approved or not of the films. Chabrol believes he would have. One of the best known filmmakers believes he would have.
When you first flip through the opening of the novel, you can almost feel the inevitability of Emma's tragic trajectory, right? As Flaubert clearly hinted this to happen. So Rachel, alongside the broader 19th century French literary trend of depicting the downfall of women who defy societal norms, how does Emma's fate reflect the cultural and societal attitudes of the time towards female autonomy or transgression?
You know, it's a time where there's a tremendous anxiety about women entering the public sphere in new ways, which they're sort of starting to do, and they're more visible perhaps on the streets of Paris. There's a lot of anxiety because you can, the class differences aren't as visible. Precisely because of the kind of shopping that Emma can do and that women can do more and more. Everyone's sort of dressed the same and can circulate more, especially in the Paris that, you know, Emma longs to go to. And so there's tremendous anxiety about women entering and the public sphere and becoming more visible. And there's also an anxiety about female sexuality. There's an anxiety about prostitution and prostitutes and prostitutes circulating in society, courtesans that you wouldn't necessarily know are you know, these kind of women. And so the 19th century novel, you know, with Flaubert and many others to follow, they love to explore female sexuality in great detail, as do doctors as well, fascinated with, you know, just almost what I like to call medical porn, these medical works that were actually sometimes circulated, sold to a popular audience, that would go into graphic descriptions and all the things that could go terribly wrong. But similarly, in a novel like this one, and in later novels by Zola, for example, you will have these heroines or anti-heroines or these female figures who the authors seem to sort of almost relish describing how they're indulging in their desires or allowing men to indulge in their desires. Of course, all within the rules of 19th century kind of literary norms. They're not really pornographic to our eyes at all. We see very little, especially with, I mean, it's not a very sexy novel for a novel about adultery, right? We don't really know what happens. We don't see what happens between bodies. But we are watching this woman kind of descend into her and embrace her desire. And we can do that, or Flaubert can do that, only if he then kind of curbs it at the end. So these women, female characters, will get explored in these, you know, over hundreds of pages. As long as at the end, you know, we put a real a cap to, we contain
that sexuality. And that happens again and again with 19th century novels. There's also a kind of, it's not a quick demise. She doesn't just sort of step off into the abyss, right? It's a prolonged description of what happens to her body. So that's also the kind of punishment has to happen at the end. We contain that story. And so there's sort of this kind of playing out of what might happen if women were to indulge in their desires, but always with this kind of safe ending that that puts a limit on it. And also, for the readers and for kind of the wider society, tells us what happens, what terrible things await if women actually do indulge.
That's great. Well, speaking of judgment, let's talk about the famous trial, which, Sanders, you argued in your essay that the trial alone offers great insight to narrative theory and literary criticism. Well, we know that Madame Bovary faced a public obscenity trial shortly after its publication in 1857, which has since become a landmark event in the history of literature and law. Could you start by providing us some background information about this historical trial? Namely, what was at the center of the debate? How did Flaubert's defense against these charges?
Sure. Yeah, it's a fascinating moment in literary history, and it's one about which scholars and historians have puzzled for a long time. So the novel was serialized in the Revue de Paris from I think it started on October 1st, 1856, to December 15th, and then the obscenity trial was the following January, so January 1857. Interestingly enough, this is the same year that Charles Baudelaire was put on trial for under the same law, the same obscenity laws, and in fact prosecuted by the same imperial prosecutor. Flaubert was acquitted. Baudelaire was convicted. And there are a lot of interesting and complex dynamics to this trial. The laws under which the both of these guys were prosecuted. Well, first of all, let me say these two moments are sort of inaugural moments for literary modernity in poetry and prose. I mean, I think we can rightly think of both Baudelaire and Flaubert as, like the great grandfathers of poetic modernism and novelistic modernism, respectively. And I think their obscenity trials are not, it's not adventitious. It's not a coincidence that these two works are so seminal. Madame Bovary, is for everybody from Joyce to Wolfe to Proust to Beckett, and everybody, and even earlier than that, Wilde. All of these people hugely indebted in many ways to Flaubert, and not for reasons that are formal as well as for reasons that have to do with the obscenity trial. And analogously from Baudelaire. So one of the interesting things is this law was originally written, I believe, in 1819, and then it was strengthened in the early 50s. So at the time that Baudelaire was writing and published this novel, this is the Second Empire, the Second Napoleonic Empire after the 1848 revolutions, and at the moment, there was a fairly freedom of the press laws were subsequently kind of loosened up, but at the moment that Flaubert was publishing, there was a fairly autocratic, repressive state apparatus in place, and these laws were written to crack down basically on political dissent, and so the Revue de Paris, where Flaubert had some friends, soon to be ex-friends, on the editorial board. This review had Republican connections, which is to say basically dissident political connections. And there is not a lot of consensus as to why exactly this novel was prosecuted. Some say it was a pretext to get at the journal. While others have Others say it was, you know, purely because of the salacious content. But the law basically states, the phrase is something like outrages against public morality and moral decency or good morals, bonne mœur.
If you have enjoyed this episode on Madame Bovary so far and desire to listen to the rest of it, please subscribe through theglobalnovel.com/subscribe. In the second half of this episode, our guest speakers will discuss dimensions considering the trial's misreading of the novel, how the Fiacre passage, which is the censored scene of Emma and Leon having sex inside the carriage, can be considered as a crucial element of the novel's form, as well as the symbolism of Emma's wedding cake. Thank you so much for listening.